But it sort of counted as the second case, since that was just, those two were like one. Jenkins versus BP. Okay, Mr. Moxon.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Shay Moxon on behalf of the appellants Lester Jenkins and Dwight Siples. Our experts reliably applied the epidemiological methodology to conclude that exposure to crude oil and dispersants from the Deepwater Horizon spill can cause chronic sinusitis. The district court, however, excluded their opinions under Daubert and granted summary judgment to BP, which we can contend was an abuse of discretion for multiple reasons. And the one I would like to start with is imposing a legally and scientifically unfounded requirement to identify a minimum harmful dose at the general causation stage of a bifurcated proceeding like this one. And our position is that nothing requires an expert to identify a threshold dose to give a reliable opinion on general causation.
Well, you've got to be able to establish something that would be different from the general risk, right? That you've got to have a benchmark about how likely it is that someone could just develop the disease without exposure.
Correct.
For general causation, right, you've got to be able to establish how that exposure, at what level that exposure will make a difference. How else can you do this?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with the last point. The first point, absolutely. The evidence has to show that the substance increases the risk of the...
No, the first part that I was talking about is... Look, just what risk is there for the general population without exposure?
Correct.
To develop the disease?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And epidemiological studies that have control groups, they show that because the control group, the unexposed cohort, faces the background risk, and the relative risk established by this study will show, when it's a positive association, will show that exposure to the substance increases the risk.
Counsel, as I understand your position, it's that, yes, there is a requirement in our case law that we show the minimum dose level for which a non-inherently toxic substance becomes toxic, right?
Correct.
Okay. Your position is simply, as a matter of law, that doesn't have to be shown at the general causation stage and only needs to be shown at the specific causation stage, right?
Correct.
Okay. I just want to explore. I just want us to be able to nail down the legal issue. So let's start with McLean. So in McLean, the way we did it is we separated it by expert there, and we started with expert O'Donnell. I don't know if O'Donnell was a doctor or not, but we started with O'Donnell. And at the beginning of the opinion, in setting out, you know, what each expert that we were going to analyze was going to do, we noted at Penn site 1237, quote, Dr. O'Donnell primarily offered opinions on general causation. And then when we got to the part about O'Donnell, we then laid out the legal standard, which I think you agree with exists, but you contest that it exists at the general causation stage, quote, this signals a methodology problem. In toxic tort cases, so in these cases, a scientific knowledge of the harmful level of exposure to a chemical plus knowledge that the plaintiff was exposed to such quantity are minimum facts necessary to sustain. A plaintiff must demonstrate the levels of exposure that are hazardous to human beings generally, and then as well as the plaintiff's actual level of exposure.
Yeah, that's the generally. That's the general causation.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, The court and the claim never said that the first part of that is for general causation and the second part is for specific.
But it said it as, but it said that in the context of the general causation expert that it was reviewing,
right,
and excluded the general causation expert because it didn't have that information. Isn't that indicative of it being a general causation standard?
Well, it said that he was offered primarily on general causation, which indicates not exclusively, and I believe perhaps the part that...
Well, that's the only part we mentioned.
We said in the same page, we affirmed the exclusion of the, again, what he says is a general causation expert, because he offered no testimony about the dose of the toxin required to injure plaintiffs or anyone else, and could not say how much is too much.
Correct, and I believe this is...
That seems to run directly counter to your argument.
Your Honor, I know, because in that discussion, which is at 1242 to 1243 of the opinion, the court is walking through four principles that talks...
It's from 1241, actually.
Okay. I'm focused on a later part that gets back to the same point.
Well,
this goes straight to the point Your Honor is raising in Judge Luck. At 1242 to 1243, as the court is walking through four criteria for determining, this is from the article by Dr. Eaton, four criteria to establish whether a chemical exposure was causally related to a specific adverse effect or disease in an individual. Already right there, these criteria have, they're pointing towards specific causation. When the court is analyzing the second of these criteria, the second Eaton criterion is the individual must have been exposed to a sufficient amount of the substance to elicit the health effect in question. This focuses on the issue of individual causation.
Right, but counsel, to know what that is, you have to establish what the toxic level is. So the first question, and I think this is what Judge Pryor was asking in his first questions to you, first question has to be, what is the toxic amount of an otherwise not toxic substance,
yeah,
such that it becomes toxic?
Yeah.
And then second, was the plaintiff in his or her daily life exposed to that,
level?
To that level?
I'm sorry, I'm taking a bit too long, but the point I'm getting at is when the court walks through these four criteria, the only one it finds missing because of the failure to identify a threshold dose is this second one.
Well, let me ask this. So let me fast forward a little bit. So in Chapman, which is some years later, under the heading general causation, we then go through this exact same discussion about dose-response relationships, literally the same stuff from McLean. Almost direct quotes from McLean, is then brought out in Chapman discussing the importance of the dose-response relationship in order to establish general causation for toxic tort cases. It's under the heading general causation.
Correct, but Chapman recognizes three possible...
It may, but my point is we're talking about something else, which is, is this a general causation standard or a specific causation standard? And Chapman seems to acknowledge how I read McLean, which is that it is a general causation standard. I'm just having trouble getting to this as a specific, even as a matter of logic. If I didn't have any case law, it would seem that generally you'd want to know what the toxic level of a substance is, and B, then you want to know specifically whether the plaintiff had been exposed to that, right?
Well, first, I want to roll back to what is the meaning of general causation? I think that should be a starting point. And I have not seen any definition in this circuit or in any scientific text or anywhere in the reference manual that includes threshold dose in the definition of general causation. It's simply whether
That's because general causation is going to be different for depending on the kind of case. In a toxic tort case, where we're in category two, where we don't inherently know. So for example, in a cigarette case, we've said you don't need to know that because cigarette smoking is inherently toxic. And so we don't need to know what the non-inherent level is of exposure because we know the exposure is enough. But in category two cases like this, and everyone agrees that it is, I touch oil every day. Every plastic product is made from some oil. How much of that I ingest it is going to cause me harm? That's the question, right?
It is a question that has to be answered at some point in most cases. Our point is that it is not required for a general causation analysis, at least not when the expert's methodology is epidemiology. It's not part of the definition of general causation.
You might want to look at the reference manual on scientific evidence, which says that general causation asks whether an agent increases the incidence of a disease in a group and not whether the agent caused any individual's disease.
Correct.
And that's the reference guide on epidemiology.
Right. And our point is it does not say whether a specific dose of an agent causes.
How do you know if it increases the risk if you don't know that?
Because in epidemiological studies, they compare unexposed individuals to exposed individuals, and it frequently is not possible to identify the specific doses for the exposed individual.
Let me ask you this. What difference does it make? You can't win without showing both the general and specific. And if you can't show and didn't present to the district court evidence showing what dose produces the disorder, the discomfort, the sinusitis, et cetera, then you can't prove anything for them. So you lose either way if you don't have a DR proof in the record.
Well, our point is that the time to identify it is at the specific causation stage. This is a bifurcated proceeding where general causation is to be decided for.
So the magistrate judge didn't pretend to decide anything about specific causation. She talked about it.
Ruling on general causation. And I know I'm getting short, getting close to my rebuttal time. To a point that I believe it was Judge Luck raised, whether a threshold dose has to be identified when the agent is generally established to be toxic. Yes, it does. And this is why I submit why Williams v. Mosaic Fertilizer is one of the strongest cases for us. Footnote 2, the court is discussing how the parties were arguing about whether this is a Category 1 case or a Category 2 case. And the court says, we need not decide this question, setting general causation aside, and then to paraphrase, to establish specific causation, the expert would still need to identify, do a dose response assessment, which he could have done only after reliably calculating how much exposure would have adversely affected her. So here's a statement saying, this is the threshold dose needs to be identified for specific causation. And because it is only necessary for specific causation, we submit that in a bifurcated proceeding like this, there's no basis to require it for general causation,
okay.
Especially.
If you don't want to eat into your rebuttal time, I think we got it. Mr. Higgs.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, George Hicks for the appellees. The magistrate judge and district court issued a combined 92 pages of opinions documenting nearly a dozen different reasons why plaintiff's expert reports should be excluded. Any one of those reasons is sufficient to affirm exclusion and uphold summary judgment. None is erroneous, much less an abuse of discretion. At the outset, this court has repeatedly made clear that a toxic tort plaintiff must demonstrate through expert testimony the level of exposure to an allegedly harmful chemical that is hazardous to a human. As the court said in McLean, quote,
At you keep blurring them, at the general causation stage. If you've got to prove it, show it, evidence it before you can prevail, that's different from saying you've got to show it on what he says was an inquiry limited to general causation.
Well, Your Honor, this court was actually doing that at the general causation stages in a number of its cases, in McLean, in Chatham.
I understand, but you didn't say that. I'm trying to get you to focus on general causation.
He's saying in Williams in footnote 2 that we sort of said, what we essentially said was that this question, the dose level question, is a specific causation question. Did we say that in footnote 2 in Williams?
Your Honor, no, I don't think that's a correct reading of footnote 2, and I don't think it's reconcilable with McLean, Chapman, last year's decision in Pinares, which all addressed this question.
Pinares is unpublished, and so is our Deepwater Horizon case. Right. But tell me what best to read footnote 2 to reconcile.
Your Honor, I would read that footnote 2 as inconsistent with the proposition that the level of exposure is a general causation inquiry. It goes towards establishing that benchmark of, you know, how much is too much or how much is too little.
Can I ask you this? It would seem to me, and I'm just speaking as a matter of logic, not as a matter of case law at the moment, that the dose level is the toxic dose level does matter based on the human being. In other words, if I'm a child, my dose level of a substance is going to be different than my dose level of a 45-year-old man. If I am someone who's a smoker, my dose level is going to be different than someone who is not a smoker. In other words, there is an overlap, it seems to me, between what the sort of toxic dose level is generally and what it would be for the human being, the plaintiff that we have in front of us, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that's not the inquiry that this court has said before.
The beginning of my question was as a matter of logic, not as a matter of case law.
Sure. I think that the level of exposure to a particular chemical might be different depending on the exact person, but I think that you know, there is some aspect to was that particular person exposed even to the minimal level that is necessary. But I think you don't even get there until you've established, at least if there is some level of social, and it's undisputed that there's nothing.
You're arguing as a matter of logic that even if our precedent is wrong, it's right, because it helps things move along, because when you get to the specific inquiry, if you don't have a dosage amount, you can't go any further. So
yes,
we get ahead of ourselves, but it's sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's exactly what the district court and the magistrate judge did here. I mean, that's why they had this inquiry first as a matter of general causation. And I know it's an unpublished decision, but if you don't even want to get into sort of the general specific breakdown, I mean, Pinares just said it's the first step of a reliable dose response assessment. So I think it's just logically the first step.
It's certainly something that has to be proven. I think Judge Carnes' question goes to that, his earlier question to your opposing counsel, which is, at some point, this has to be proven. It's necessary in order to show a causation in the case. The question is where, and because of the bifurcated nature of this, it actually matters, where in Pinares, which was not bifurcated, it didn't matter. So that's why the learned author of that opinion made that statement. What I would like to ask is this. Chapman, I think, could fairly be said to cloudy the waters a little bit. Your opposing counsel started to go down this road, and I sort of shifted him to what I thought the question I wanted to ask him about, but his where he started to go down seems to be right, which is Chapman seems to indicate that there are three methodologies for establishing general causation: dose-response relationship, toxicity, and epidemiology. And so what do we do where we have these three things, and they've said, okay, we choose door number three to go down, and I'm assuming for the moment that that they reasonably applied epidemiology. I know the district court thinks that they didn't, and I know you argue they didn't, but assume for the moment that they did. What do we make of that, and what do we do with that?
Your Honor, if I understand this to be appellant's sort of epidemiology carve-out, is I think that the way they're describing it.
I'll let you get away with that. I'm not sure that's a fair description of it. I mean, I just think they're saying Chapman says there's three doors, and we're going through door number three.
Well, I think a couple of responses, Your Honor. Number one, I don't think that McLean or Chapman itself ever limited the inquiry or the analysis to a particular category. you know, whether it's toxicology, epidemiology, you know, what have you. The expert in McLean, and I believe in Chapman, was not a toxicologist. But I also think that, you know, pulling it back a little bit, the standard of review here is abuse of discretion. And so if there's going to be this epidemiology carve out or just a understanding of Chapman that might be, you know, creating some sort of different approach that I don't think would be apparent on the face of McLean or Chapman, I don't think you can fault the district court or the magistrate judge for not recognizing that and concluding that it was so manifestly erroneous that would constitute an abuse of discretion. In addition to all the other problems with reliability.
So because our case law is cloudy, the district court can't abuse its discretion. Is that the argument you're making?
Well, I don't think your case law is cloudy, Your Honor. I think your case law is very clear about this being a requirement in all cases. And I think the reason for that is the reasons you've given in Chapman and in McLean about the need to establish that benchmark in all cases, because you have to know in a toxic tort case, whatever the case, the benchmark is.
Let me ask you about one potential answer and then a second potential answer. So the potential answer, number one, is while Chapman seems to suggest there are three ways to go about causation, what McLean says is, as a matter of law, to prove general causation, not what is allowable expert testimony, but what, as a matter of law, is required to be proven for general causation requires a minimum dose level for toxicity. And if whatever expert you're proffering and the only evidence you have doesn't have that, then whether the expert should have been admitted or not does not meet your summary judgment burden. Is that one way to look at this?
I think that is a way to look at it, because it's recognizing that there is always going to be that need to establish some sort of benchmark requirement. I mean, it's why, I mean, all, as the court has said, all substances can be potentially toxic. Oil can be potentially toxic in some sense. Low dose exposures, though, for many years will have no consequence at all. So I think you do have to establish that.
So then I guess the question is, and I think that that's probably right, but I guess the question is, then is this really a Daubert question or an evidentiary question for what's required in order to meet your burden at summary judgment when summary judgment is filed?
Yeah, I think most other courts of appeals, as far as I know, in fact, all of them have treated it as a Daubert question, because you need expert evidence to show that benchmark. I mean, that's completely out of the realm of lay understanding, and that's...
But I guess my question is, imagine in a world where no expert testimony was presented, you would file a motion for summary judgment stating that there's expert testimony that's needed for this necessary element, that is the toxicity level. They haven't provided it, so we win for summary judgment. In fact, I feel like I've seen that exact case coming out of these below back-end litigation cases.
Well, sure. If there's simply no expert testimony whatsoever,
right,
on the benchmark level of exposure that's required.
So isn't that what we have, essentially? In other words, they have an expert. The expert testifies to expert-y kind of things, but we just don't have an expert on this critical fact that we've said in McLean is necessary.
It is, Your Honor. And that's why I think, Judge Carnes alluded to it, I think Judge Pryor did as well, that it's simply a requirement that, you know, we think is a threshold requirement, but it is something that has to be proven. And I think the court's cases make it pretty clear that it's a general causation stage inquiry, but also that logically makes sense, because, you know, whether you want to call it efficiency, whether you want to call it logic, you know, in the sense of establishing that benchmark, you have to have it at some point. And it's not like there's been any point in any of the briefing at any time when the plaintiffs had said, yes, and eventually we're going to provide that.
Well, I am sympathetic where a court, listen, you have a very efficient court that you're in front of a district court, where it is set a schedule of we're going to do this first and then that later. You can't blame them for not doing what is required to be done later right now. So I'm very sympathetic to that argument, if they're right that this is a specific causation thing. But if it is a requirement of general causation up front, then I think then at that point they have to meet their burden. So that was door number one, or way number one. Way number two to around this, I think, is the rest of your briefing, which is they didn't even do epidemiology right. Even if that is an avenue to go through, there are so many problems with it that their reports are both unhelpful and unreliable, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I would be happy to turn to that.
Please.
Well, and this again, I think, goes to the abuse of discretion standard and the fact that the district court and the magistrate judge found numerous reasons why the two experts' reports were unreliable.
I think the key one is the Rizieki. I'm going to pronounce that incorrectly, but the Rizieki study.
Well, Your Honor, the plaintiffs call it the key report. This is a report that garnered literally one paragraph in one of the experts' reports, and I think maybe two in the other, and it almost got barely any attention below. It's only on appeal that they have turned it into, you know, kind of swinging for the fences as the key report, but there are many inconsistencies.
That sounds like an ad hominem abusive argument or first cousin of it. I don't think that helps. I mean, if the report bolsters their position, they could just say, see page 27 of the report.
Well, Your Honor, I don't mean to be saying that it's anything like
what
that.
What I'm trying to get you to do is dig into the merits about the report
and
why it doesn't support their position.
Absolutely, because the report, in addressing the Rizieki report, doesn't address any of the many inconsistencies in that report. It doesn't address the fact that it was self-reported symptoms. It doesn't address the fact
how would you get non-self-reported symptoms from 10,000 people or whatever it was?
I believe it's a difference between going to them or maybe having them. I don't know the exact difference between it, but the self-reporting is tertiary. The main thing is the fact that in every subgroup save one, and there's a caveat to that, there was no statistically significant risk of increased condition based on exposure. In two of the subgroups, there was actually a reduced risk. And in the one subgroup that found a statistically significant increase, that actually went away once you adjusted for smokers. And so
you're talking about inhalation or not inhalation subgroups?
One of the subgroups.
I don't think you can. Their point is sinusitis. You get exposed to it by inhaling. Therefore, the critical subgroup is the inhalers.
Well, Your Honor, I understand them to be making that argument now. I don't think that you can still reconcile that with the fact that one of the subgroups was responders who were around the burning oil, which I think involves some sort of inhalation as well, but that found no significant increase. And so we can have a colloquy about that as to what it
didn't
be. That's the job of the expert in the report.
Didn't the definition of exposure include inhalation? In other words, inhalation was part of the larger exposure.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's
inhalation kind of all over the place. And again, I think that these are things that are supposed to be addressed in the report.
I think y'all didn't connect on that. Inhalation was included is not the same thing as inhalation was required. If you included inhalers in the group, that's not the same thing as saying we only included inhalers in the group. My understanding was their primary argument is based upon the subgroup of inhalers.
I understand their primary argument to be based on that subgroup as well, but it doesn't dissuade from the fact that in the other subgroups there was an inhalation element. I mean, certainly in the vicinity of burning oil, but also none of this was addressed in the reports. That's the methodological flaw that both courts below found, and I don't think that you can conclude that's an abuse of discretion on appeal, particularly what this court has said about district courts being uniquely entrusted to determine these fact-laden issues. I see my time is up.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Hicks. Mr. Moxon, you saved 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, briefly, about the distinction between epidemiology and other types of methodologies or focuses, the court should keep in mind that the purpose of the Daubert inquiry is to ensure that the expert is following the principles and methods of their own methodology. That is what the reliability inquiry is.
But there's at least like 20 pages in for each expert in the magistrate judge's very thorough report and recommendation that go to the helpfulness and reliability of epidemiology, going through the same reference manual that y'all do, the Eaton manual. Why is that not, at least for some of those things, not an abuse of discretion for the judge to have looked at all of that?
Well, the magistrate judge did abuse her discretion in her reliability inquiry.
Well, let me give you one example. So your opposing counsel just said that one problem, I think especially with, it's not Freeman, but the other expert, Dr. Solomon. Dr. Solomon's report didn't discuss any of these inconsistencies between the inhalation group, the subgroup, and all these other exposure subgroups. Now, the explanation could be the one that Judge Collins just mentioned, which is one required just inhalators and the others didn't. But as I understand, I can go through the page, cite and page of the Eden manual, that is a requirement of proper epidemiology, is to go through the limitations of a report, explain them away, and show why the association either is a causation or is not.
Well, first on these inconsistencies, these alleged inconsistencies, our experts never perceived any inconsistency in the results. And frankly, I don't either. And this is
between being exposed to the very toxic substance and your illness, the chronic illnesses going down versus in one particular subgroup where smokers are included, it going up. You don't see that as something you might want to explain?
Your Honor, there are no, here's what these alleged inconsistencies show. Merely being a responder versus not a responder, that doesn't increase the risk. Merely having any type of exposure, getting it on your skin, wading in oily water, swallowing a little bit of it, when all these different types of exposure pathways are grouped together, that doesn't increase it. But when the data for just the responders who inhaled oil fumes were extracted out, they do show an increase.
What about Dr. O'Connell not discussing any of the confounding factors, including the biggest one for inhalation, smoking?
This was explained too. The
not in the report. In her report?
The report said that the sensitivity analysis confirmed the findings, because that's true. This thing and this smoking sensitivity analysis has been misrepresented repeatedly in the report and recommendation and here. What happened was a sensitivity analysis. This wasn't an adjustment to the study. It was a little test. It was just to see, did we do a good job controlling for smoking when we calculated our numbers? Because the numbers in the main study, they were controlled for smoking statistically. And so in the supplemental analysis, a little test was done. Well, what happens if we exclude all smokers anyway and see what happens? What happened was the relative risks stayed just about the same. One of them was only one percentage point off.
Okay.
It stayed the same, and it only lost statistical significance because it was cut in half. And our experts explained that in their depositions, and the magistrate judge just dismissed that out of hand and accused Dr. Solomon of a wholesale failure to discuss limitations, which...
Counsel, you said that the studies comparisons were not adjusted for smoking.
Or, they were, yes.
All right.
Comparisons in Rusiecki except for responder versus non-responder.
Yeah, the report says our analysis for the within responder exposure comparisons, parentheses, end parentheses, were adjusted for age, sex, and smoking status.
Yes.
But it doesn't say how they were adjusted. I mean, couldn't find anything in the report about how they were adjusted. You can't have a report that your expert relies on that says basically, trust us, we took care of that.
This was not an issue that was ever raised about Rusiecki. It has never been that they did a bad job with their statistic process for controlling for it. And I would add that the whole purpose of that smoking sensitivity...
So you're saying everybody agreed they adjusted properly, even though nobody knew how they adjusted?
Nobody raises a concern with that, and I would just assume that it's because The statistical methods are well known and maybe didn't need to explain. But unfortunately, the sensitivity analysis and the supplemental tables, that was a check of whether it was done properly. And what happened was,
Mr. Moxon, we got to wrap this up at some point. You're 2.5 minutes over.
I understand. We submit that the district court abused its discretion in imposing these unfounded requirements and in stepped outside its role of ensuring whether the expert opinions were reliable and crossed the line into reviewing the correctness of their conclusions. We ask the court to reverse.
Thank you. Move on to our next pair.